I've been thinking a lot about this Inside Llewyn Davis movie and who is better equipped to take advantage of a folk music renaissance than me. I could record a new folk song and become this overnight sensation. I could perform it on YouTube in front of my parents' Christmas tree and get like 640 unique views. Actually, that sounded more like a dead end when I said it out loud than when I was thinking about it, but let's just try something. Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Wow, that is really depressing. Do folk songs have to be so final? All right, how about this? Alternative sentence me, put a breathalyzer in my car. Make me talk to those school groups about how crime won't get you far. Make me read Russian novels, put a bracelet on my ankle. Divert me from prison, and I promise... What rhymes with ankle? Why have a body part that nothing rhymes with? You know what that is? Society looking down its nose at me. It really pisses me off. I shouldn't use such coarse language. I should say it really rankles me. That's much more elegant. It really rankles me. Now, what was I so upset about? Oh yeah, the fact that no other word rhymes with ankle. So frustrating. I feel like I have no choice but to start using meth again. Today, the nose goes deep, deep, deep inside Llewyn Davis. And now he had a hit in 62 with Cough, the Allergic Monkey, Colin McEnroe.
Cough, the Allergic Monkey. You remember that one, right? All right, yes, we're going to be talking a lot about Inside Llewyn Davis, a brand new Coen Brothers movie today here on The Nose. And to do that, we have with us from The Cut, a magazine for the rapidly aging young adults of Connecticut. Teresa Kramer from Trinity Cine Studio, where you will eventually go to see Inside Llewyn Davis, if you can wait, or maybe you'll go to see it a second time, which we recommend, is James Hanley, and with us, who's a person who's already seen Inside Llewyn Davis twice, the folk czarina, folk legend, because we had to have a folk legend here, Susan Forbes Hansen is also with us. So should I mention, like, where all your shows are on? Should you mention where all your shows are on?
I'd be happy to.
Where are all your shows? I can't keep
all,
track.
All of my shows, yeah. All two of them.
Yes.
One is on Friday mornings at WWUH, and one is on Sunday evenings at WHUS.
All right. So she does folk. She knows folk music. So
yeah,
we thought it would be good to have somebody here who actually
likes it.
Talk knowledgeably about the folk music part of all this. We'd love to have you be part of this conversation too. 860-275-7266. That's the number to call. 860-275-7266. We'll be exploring a lot of different aspects of this movie, ranging from how you feel about Coen Brothers movies generally, to how you feel about folk music generally, to how you feel specifically about this movie, and what kinds of questions this movie raises about artistry and persistence and depression and misanthropy and probably a bunch of other things I haven't thought of. 860-275-7266. Greg Hill is tweeting at you and receiving your tweets at WNPR Colin. So lots of ways to communicate with us. All right, come back with me. The year is 1961. It's about 10 minutes. Almost. There are certain spoilers that we will absolutely not foist upon you. We will be as careful as we can. I mean, it's not like The Crying Game or anything anyway. It's not like they're like big things that, you know, it's a hard movie to wreck. But there's certain things we won't tell you. But it's, you know, in certain senses, it's like almost literally 20 minutes before Bob Dylan in 1961 in the village. There's a folk scene already going. Just to sort of key it in a little bit more, it's almost exactly the same time that Woody Allen goes to the bitter end and is a Greenwich Village nightclub comic, like almost exactly at that same moment. Almost exactly at that same moment, perhaps relevantly, the first ever approved birth control pill is put on the market, although women have actually been using for a few years that product prescribed differently. There's a lot of things going on is what I'm trying to say. And so we meet Llewyn Davis. He is a saturnine folk singer. He's an unhappy guy, and he's having a really, really bad week. And this is very much the story of his really, really bad week. And I guess maybe where to begin, let's just sort of begin with the movie itself. Teresa Kramer, I know you're something of a Coen Brothers fan. Mm-hmm. One goes into a Coen Brothers movie with certain expectations, but that's usually a bad idea because they don't really make the same movie over and over again. They often make radically different movies. But where does this stand in your pantheon of Coen Brothers movies?
Well, the main reason I was excited about this was not the movie so much as the music, because before you asked me to be on the show, I posted something on Facebook about how I thought the Coen Brothers had more had done more to influence my musical taste than The Lilith Fair and my friend Patrick put together. Because, so I was really excited about the music. I was obsessed with the soundtrack for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou when it came out, and I grew to love Gillian Welch and who else is on that? Jeez, Alison Krauss and all these other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really excited about it. And I did, like, I had one worry that, much like the movie Once, you remember that movie?
The movie Once, yes.
Yes, I fell asleep during that. I loved the music, but I found the movie to be incredibly boring and slow, and I could not take it. But this was much funnier, and, you know, it worked the music in well, and I liked it quite a bit.
I'm so impressed that you feel comfortable saying what you just said on the air in front of, you know, however many people are listening right now, because I didn't really like Once very much either, but I found it was I would achieve an almost Llewyn Davis-like level of unpopularity
yes.
when I mentioned that I didn't like Once. It's a little bit like screaming at the lady who's playing the zither, you know, or whatever.
Well, it's just so, it was so soothing, too, that I was like, if you lay down on a couch and watch that, you are out like a light.
The song is, the main song is really stupid, too. But anyway, let's not get it. Well, anyway, I'm going to just quickly take all of your temperatures on this movie. James, kind of same question. I mean, just to get our conversation going, did you like it? Did you not?
Yeah,
like it?
I loved it. I was entranced with it, and I immediately wanted to see it again. I think it's something that it's a very special type of film, being a Coen Brothers film. I loved the music as well. But what I liked about it was that it made a kind of anti-hero a fascinating character to watch. And for whatever, there are a few little flaws I might criticize it for, but I just found a reality to it that really absorbed me. And it just brought back that period so well in terms of the sort of incipient angst underneath that's going on. And Oscar Isaac is just such a fascinating portrayal. He gives this character such life. And
what do you think the incipient angst is?
Well, it's kind of like things are. There's a kind of darkness to the movie that all of the things, the street itself, the tiny apartments in New York City, kind of thing. Like there's the hallway where the front doors are sort of jammed right next to each other, and everything is sort of like. Seems to be kind of under pressure, and there's the dark highways and the bleak bus station kind of thing in the snow. All of these things are kind of like harbingers of something that is, it's come to a place where things have to change kind of thing. And there's actually a kind of interesting counterpoint to the film in that it manages to be of that period but not be political. It doesn't really raise the sort of political side of it in a way that it really was. I mean, people were raptly listening to music like that because of its political content, and the film doesn't really address that, which I don't think is a problem in the context of the film, but I thought that was interesting, too.
That's actually a good, great segue for Susan Forbes Hansen, because I'm wondering about that, too, is how, at that moment, how political would they have been? I mean, the closest thing to a topical song we hear is this nonsensical song that Justin Timberlake's character is recording, which we can talk a little bit about in a second. But give us your overall reactions.
Well, I like the film. I didn't think I was going to, because there was so much negative response in the folk community. Oh my God, they're making a film about Dave Van Ronk. Oh my God, they've made a film and it's not about Dave Van Ronk. But I think he's Isaacs, I think, is a wonderful performer. He's a wonderful singer, which you don't expect from an actor. And of course, that's been stated in many places in Roger Catlin's article and other articles as well. And, you know, I lived in New York slightly after that. I moved down there, I think, in 62, but was not part of any sort of folk scene or anything. That came much later in my life. So I don't know that much about the music. I knew that kind of popular, traditional thing like everybody did. You know, that
maybe you could explain to people first of all, this movie is very loosely based on Dave Van Ronk, who apparently, according to his ex-wife, who I read interviewed in New York Magazine or somewhere, was actually a much more cheerful
and genial
fellow. But musically, or like in terms of who he was on the spectrum, do you feel able to kind of give us a sense of who exactly this guy was? Or Have you played Dave Van Ronk songs on your shows, I would assume, over the years?
Yeah. Sure. And he started out singing a mix of stuff. He was not a folk singer. He didn't consider himself a folk singer. He sang blues. He sang traditional stuff. He dabbled in jazz a little bit. But what he did became part of the folk scene, which was a pretty good-sized thing. Around the corner somewhere there in the village, Alan Block, father of Rory Block, fine fiddler and sandal maker, had a shop, and people were always visiting there and making music while he's making sandals, and then he would put the sandals down and pick up the fiddle. And so there's music everywhere in that area. And I think Van Ronk just became a part of that whole melange and became very much a leader, very much a teacher to so many people. I mean, people talk about Dylan sleeping on his couch, but everybody slept on his couch. Mm-hmm. You know, Dylan was not the only guest they had in that apartment. And folks from here, Bruce Pratt, Jim Mersick, Stan Sullivan would go down and take lessons from him. He was a teacher and a performer and a writer. So... Mm-hmm.
I'm going to swing back over to Teresa for a second. So, you know, you talked about the way in which Oh Brother, Where Art Thou really kind of shaped your musical perceptions, put mm-hmm. you on a different road. Mm-hmm. It's the other Coen Brothers movie that's a lot about music, although I would argue this one's even more about music. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's about almost nothing else but music. Is it likely to have a similar effect on you? I mean, are you going to start listening to Susan Forbes Hansen's shows even more?
Well, I'm going
than
to because I met Susan, but... Well, I don't know that – I don't think it now has the opportunity to stick me on a different road. I mean, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou already sent me down the sort of old-timey music road.
That's a proper term. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You don't have to make air quotes.
The people on the radio can't see me.
Yeah.
The movie you mentioned, Colin, in our emails, what was it called? The documentary?
Oh, it's called Another Day, Another Time.
Well, a lot of the bands that are featured on there, I'd heard of recently, either through Colin or through other things. The Milk Carton Kids in particular, I heard in a different movie and was like, who is that? I thought it was Simon and Garfunkel.
Just to frame what she's saying a little bit, because I'll be talking about this maybe a little bit later, either mm-hmm. during the endorsements or later in our conversation. One of the many things that has kind of spun out of this, and this is something that the Coen brothers have done in the past, is a documentary that's unfortunately available only on Showtime at the moment, as far as I know. It's called Another Day, Another Time, and then it's subtitled like a tribute to the music of Inside Llewyn Davis. Mm-hmm. And it includes performances by everybody from Joan Baez to the Punch Brothers to kind of the bubbling up under acts here, like the Milk Carton Kids and like Lake Street Dive.
And one of the things I was wondering, thinking about this, not so much for me because I already liked the old-timey music, but for, you know, the people in Brooklyn who are farming in their backyard, and is this like a new, will this spur like a new folk revival in among a certain element in New York where, I mean, you've already got groups like the Milk Carton Kids, and I mean, the Avett Brothers aren't quite in that milieu, but close, and the Lone Bellow and all these bands, and I wonder if we've got a new thing bubbling here.
Oh, I want to talk about that mm-hmm. as we go along, but because I think that's one of the questions is does this. I mean, it seems to me that the kind of Americana roots music thing just sort of keeps happening, and we mm-hmm. keep talking about it like it just started happening, and maybe it really never stops happening. But just to stay with the movie for a second, James, first of all, is this to you recognizably, stylistically, a Coen Brothers movie? I mean, I'm not even sure. I mean, I just got a tweet from Howard Sherman saying his favorite Coen Brothers movies are Blood Simple, Hudsucker, Proxy, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is, among other things, the typical tribute to the just incredible diversity of their work. I mean, yeah. those are three movies that do not in significant ways resemble one another. Are there things about this that make it a Coen Brothers movie, or is there no such thing?
Well, that's the question. And I think that actually one of the reasons I always want to see a Coen Brothers movie is because it is always going to take some sort of unexpected direction. It's something that has just knowing them and seeing their previous films, there's this progression, if you like, onto different things. They're fascinated with portrayals that are really off center, if you like. And I can imagine that a film like Llewyn Davis is a something that would be very hard to project to get investors to get interested in initially, but you know the
pretty
Coen
much like
brothers,
Llewyn Davis himself.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, they look at that and say, "But wait a minute, this guy, you know, he's depressed and like he's not functional in a lot of ways." And sort of, what's the hook on this film? Kind of thing is the cat. You know, it's like And so, but the remarkable thing is that the Coen brothers have this reputation, and the people do wait to see these films. And I'm hoping in particular that this film is something that actually catches the imagination and can stay in the market long enough for people to find it and really enjoy it. And I think, Teresa, what you're saying about the music is true as well, that, you know, so many of these things are evanescent, you know. Like, I feared for this film coming out at Christmas time because there were all of these big, loud blockbusters coming along. Would it be able to retain its screens? Would it be in the market long enough to actually get people to be curious about it and see something that they might not see as having proven advanced values other than the Coen brothers' name? But for me, I certainly, as soon as I saw that it was coming out, I wanted to see it right away.
Well, you know, as many people as feel it's a work of genius, and people like A.O. Scott, he made it his number one movie on his top 10 list. There are people, and I hope we'll hear from them by phone or tweet, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, or you may tweet us at WNPR Colin. There are people, and I've encountered them, as I've made my way through the holiday party circuit, who really hated this movie, who hated the protagonist, who felt as though that the movie kind of caught them. I had a little bit of a sense of, I mean, you go into a Coen Brothers movie with a couple of Coen Brothers movies on your mind, usually. You know, maybe it'll be a little like this, maybe it'll be a little bit like that. And to me, this isn't very much like any Coen Brothers movie, although I could draw a few parallels here and there. And even for me, and I'm a Coen Brothers fan, this movie, at the end of this movie, it's sort of, I had the experience, sometimes a movie catches you in a situation where you feel as though the movie is still inhaling, but in fact, it's exhaling, its final exhale, you know. So when the movie ended, I thought, that's it.
Not a very long movie either.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, did everybody have overwhelmingly positive reactions?
No, I felt at the end of it, I was really like, I thought that this was something that was, it feels kind of almost like an intellectual and emotional challenge to watch a movie about somebody who is dysfunctional, but who's fascinatingly talented, and who actually, the music is fascinating around it. The film is filled with symbols and things that are going on around it. There are fascinating images. I mean, to me, if anybody had asked me right after I saw it, it would have been that it was a kind of tour de force of cinema, in that it had a sense of the visual that actually was very exciting and thrilling, but it tied it to this dysfunctional man who is really an interesting character. But if somebody asked you, well, you know, was he a hero kind of thing? Well, no, he's not. And it doesn't have that kind of classical structure. But they've managed to create, to me, a film that when I came out of it, I immediately wanted to see it again for that reason.
You said you wanted to punch Louis.
Yes. There were several times in the movie where I don't like that sort of... he's neurotic and misanthropic and not all that. I don't know, but
you're the last
person
on the show I would have expected to see standing up against neuroses and misanthropy.
No, I have no neuroses. I have plenty of misanthropy. But
fair enough.
But I found myself not liking him, and at the same time, really just like wanting to hug him. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt
that's
bad
exactly
for him.
The point to me.
Exactly.
That's exactly what
and
makes him a fascinating
sort of
character.
He wins me back at the end with his last performance of "Fare Thee Well," which I loved, and I even on the soundtrack, I prefer that version to the studio version with Marcus Mumford, and then it just sort of, you're like, oh well. What happened? And I guess you know nothing happens for him because of who shows up during that performance.
We can't say.
Actually, well, if you can't figure it out, though.
Everybody else has.
Let people chew on this a little bit. Let's hear, although we've already played it once this week, but let's hear it anyway, since you just mentioned Fare Thee Well. This is the duet, and I think you will hear Marcus Mumford singing the other part. This is the duet that Llewyn Davis did with his former partner. He's no longer partnered up with this guy. The suggestion in the movie is that this was a more popular act than Llewyn Davis perhaps was ever going to be as a solo act.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
So to me, I think there is one of the things that – I mean, if I have so many things I want to say about this, and so see if I can loop them all into one statement. First of all, I do feel as though whenever you're talking to anybody about a movie that – leaves certain questions unanswered and is enigmatic, you're going to run into two schools of people. The people that you at some point in your life could have successfully sent to see The Seventh Seal with the idea that they would really enjoy it, or the people who would get furious at you because you sent them to see The Seventh Seal. You know, and I mean, there are two different temperaments about movies. There are some people who really enjoy coming out of a movie and having a long conversation with two or three other people about what did that movie mean? What significance was there to this cat, you know, in this movie? Who was, you know, what sort of message was John Goodman's character supposed to be bringing? Us on and on. To what degree is this yet another Coen Brothers movie that plays on ideas about the Odyssey and Joyce's Ulysses? And we can talk about all these things today. But there's some people who don't want to be sitting in the car afterwards having that conversation. They would like a lot of their questions answered. But for me, as I pondered this movie, I really did think for me, and some of it has to do with some other encounters that I've had recently with people and conversations that I found myself having, it really is a question about art and artistry and connoisseurship and curation. It's a, you know, Llewyn Davis in this movie plays a guy who basically thinks that he's committed to a certain kind of music and to doing a certain kind of music a certain way. He doesn't want to do any of the other things that he is told would be more successful for him. He doesn't really care whether people like what he's doing. he's pathologically uninterested, except that, and he is just not willing to, you should pardon the expression, kiss ass. He just won't do it. He won't even be as ingratiating as Bob Dylan, who is not famously ingratiating, but he doesn't even have that level of spark or charm. But I think we are meant to conclude that he's a really good musician and that the music that he cares about is significant and worth everybody hearing. And to suddenly there's like this there are all these kind of aesthetic questions that well up. I see you fidgeting over there, so I'll just hand the baton to you since you want to react to something.
I don't know where I am now. I was one of the things that I was surprised by with all of his armor built around him and so forth, was that clearly he was touched by the death of his partner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when he sings the song and he's furious with Lillian, name?
He sings this particular song at a dinner party, and it's really the first time he's ever sung it by himself.
Right.
And what the hostess tries to sing along with him, and he, in sort of an exhibition of his typical Philistinism, becomes enraged.
Right. And up until, you know, up until that, when I started to realize that he had been touched by this and wasn't just made of stone or whatever, I couldn't bear him. I couldn't understand how people would keep giving to him. You know, here, yes, you can stay here. You can stay here. You can stay here. Here's some money and so forth. Just
well,
funny.
I think that very thing, though, is that's what is a major theme of the film, which is that there's something else other than that, other than expectation. There's something other than, you know, like somebody who's unlikable in some ways is also recognizable as a different kind of person in another way. And all of these clashes are that take place in the movie are kind of like it's kind of like telling a story about don't look at what you first see. That actually look at this character, explore this character, an uncomfortable character. It's kind of like the people who come out of a film and they want to be sort of reassured in some way that, okay, whatever crisis has been raised in the film, whatever criticism, whatever bad things happened in the film have somehow been resolved. If not happily, at least they know what happened. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of people who are rendered very disturbed by that. And I think that his character in the film is a disturbing character. And it's fascinating to see how people's misjudgment of that mood, that character, can sometimes lead to incredible clashes. And I'd bring in the cat again. You know, the whole identity of the cat appearing and disappearing in the film, and the way the cat is like a constant thread. It's almost like a reminder that, wait a minute, that this dysfunctional character all of a sudden has this kind of off the wall relationship with a cat. That he's sort of like trying to protect, and yet the cat doesn't want to be protected. And all of this is playing into the whole relationship issue with the people who are so angry at him.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I don't think he likes the cat. I mean, he's
no,
there's
that's
no,
it.
No pleasure in being around this cat. No. It's strictly because the Gorfines
exactly.
are going to.
Yeah, we can just we'll just quickly set the cat stage for you. So one of the themes in this movie. This is not a spoiler. It starts very early in the movie. He's borrowing somebody's apartment. Their cat gets out, and one of the few times we see him exhibit some sense of responsibility mm-hmm. towards anybody else. He's concerned that these people will be very upset because their cat has gotten lost, and it'll be his fault. Let me just sort of offer my own little sort of hobby horse idea about all this. And this is probably among the three of you the most open audience to this line of argument will be Teresa, I think. But some of it actually comes from a set of emails I got from a disgruntled listener this week who was complaining about the fact that frequently when we do a show about music, we often set it up, and we've done it twice in particular that she was aware of, once or several times about traditional Irish music. And then more recently, we reran on Tuesday an old show of ours about Christmas music. And I do tend to set up these shows saying, you know, maybe you think you hate Christmas music. You're ready to tear your head off if you hear Little Drummer Boy again. Well, here's some really interesting, you know, music that we've kind of curated differently, and we've got Eric Danton and Joan Holliday. We're going to introduce you to, maybe you didn't know, Paul Westerberg did a Christmas song, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. And we do it with Irish music too. It's like you think Irish music and your mind goes to Dear Old Donegal or some really horrible, you know, treacly thing, you know, and there's this amazing trove of Irish music which we present with Steve Dietrich on occasions, usually around St. Patrick's Day. Anyway, this woman was sort of upset with me because I couldn't simply present this really good music. I had to talk about the kind of music that it was an alternative to, music that I really despise. You know, why do you need to do that? And I think one of the messages of Llewyn Davis is the embrace of anything implies a rejection of a whole series of other alternatives. Mm-hmm. In order to be passionate about something, you have to be prepared to reject other things. You have to be prepared to tell somebody, no, I could not imagine joining myself to a group that would be ultimately Peter, Paul, and Mary, mm-hmm. you know, a possibility that he rejects. You have to be prepared to tell the other person in the studio that the song you're recording together is a piece of garbage, assuming that he knows that too, which turns out not to be the case in one occasion. And you basically, I mean, you can do it perhaps a little bit more genially, but part of being passionate about anything is to know that other things certainly, that they don't meet your particular standard. And to me, he's an interesting embodiment of that sentiment.
Yeah.
And I felt less bad about my own snark,
yeah.
Teresa.
But what about your smarm comment? Shout out to 2 weeks ago. I think part of what's winning about Llewyn Davis is that his commitment to it. So if he was just sort of, he has the talent to back it up, because I definitely find myself at the end of the movie being like, I would buy this guy's album. I don't know why anyone else wouldn't. And, but you know, he's sort of unpleasant. And the reason people take him, because I found myself saying, you know, I kind of want to punch this guy, but I probably in real life, I'd probably also try to make out with him and, you know, make his life better or something.
One thing would have that other effect.
Yeah,
what you're saying.
Yes.
Pretty clear about it.
And, but so I think his passion about these things that that make the people in his life forgive him, of those who do forgive him, and I'm not sure everybody does. But that I think it is the passion that wins people over, that gets Lillian to let him back in the house and give him a big hug and apologize to him, even though he's the one who freaks out on her.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's true, yes.
Let's take a little break here. We'll head out to our break with actually a song that Llewyn plays at a moment when he's been given a huge commercial opportunity, which he's going to blow.
For 9 days or more, till the women grew so tired. No longer there, they could no longer there.
Good. All right, we're back. We're going to just continue our conversation about Inside Llewyn Davis for just a few more minutes here. We've got some other things to get to. And, of course, at the end of the show, we'll be doing endorsements. Quickly, Howard Sherman tweeting to us. We should have Howard on the show today. He's tweeting on what makes a Coen Brothers movie. He says, semi-detached to nearly condescending view of human failings and eccentricity, sometimes leavened with sweetness, e.g. Fargo. And that's a pretty good formula for a Coen Brothers movie to whatever degree it is. You know, one of the things, just to go back to Llewyn Davis, and by the way, if you want to chime in, be part of the conversation. We'll be on this for a few more minutes. The number 860-275-7266, or join Howard Sherman in tweeting us at WNPR Colin. But the number is 860-275-7266. You know, James, it struck me that one of the responses that this movie was making was maybe a response to, I mean, this is an era that the Coen brothers did not, given their age, directly experience. Mm. But a notion that there might have been people in this era who are an antidote to the attitude of today. The attitude of today being almost anything can be made into a wry, dry, or ironic joke. You know, that in a way that not only is Llewyn Davis impossible now, but really the original Dylan is almost impossible now. I don't know.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, what you're talking about is genuine and real. That genuine and real is increasingly hard to attain in any sort of way, especially something that is taking a tack that is not seeking sort of commercial success openly by taking on a difficult character, for example, or having a difficult performance that might be really good but is hard to sell kind of thing. I mean, everything now with all of our various media connections and all of the requirements that producers get their money back really quickly, I don't think it's very, very hard to bring in real originality in that way. And I think that there's something about the fascination with that period in New York City and the whole community, actually, not just the folk community, the incipient folk community, but the whole fact that it was sort of some sort of organic growth of something that it boiled over, of course, with the Stonewall riots in 1969, which had all sorts of connections. I mean, that was about particular issues for the gay and transgender and community, but it was also linked to all of the movements that were happening at the time about protest and war and so on. And there was a kind of authenticity there in that, I don't know, I felt about that period that you knew individuals in a way that they were committed to do things. You knew individuals who actually were in all of their flaws, you know, people who could be really good at leading a crowd, whipping a crowd up to get a reaction, but they would be miserable at being interviewed, for example, and getting a word across to a newspaper reporter or something like that. There's this sort of reality to that, and that's what's appealing to me about this story. It has that kind of reality, and I think that too often there's a formulaic quality that some filmmakers escape. I think the Coen brothers, because of their reputation and because of the fact that they make films, and they plainly make films with what they want to do. They do exactly what they want to do, and they're not paying attention to somebody telling them, well, you know, that's not commercial or something. And so they're uniquely equipped to be able to tell some of those stories, and they pick something out of the past that actually is very seminal to the whole development of social awareness in American life that has been anesthetized to a great extent by predictable media, I think. And that's what's so exciting to me about it.
And I wonder if Susan Forbes Hansen is somebody who really is, a titanic figure in playing folk music and introducing people to folk music. Do you feel as though that sentiment and everything that James is just talking about is really kind of archived in that past, or is it as alive and every bit as vibrant and every bit as genuine in the music that comes over your transom these days, people asking you, please, please, please play this song on your show?
Well, of course I'm going to say that I think it's still alive. And
is it alive in the same way?
Well, nothing. It's not starting.
Yeah.
Which it was starting. Mm-hmm. So it's not starting. So it's a continuation. So it's not that, it's not the element of surprise necessarily. I mean, some people are surprised by the milk carton kids and whoever they're hearing. people who have not necessarily heard that kind of music before. But for people like me who have been hearing variations on that theme for a long time, it's not new. So it has to be really, really good. Mm. And I don't want to say sincere, but just honestly done.
I think authentic is the word.
Right.
That's a real sort of sense that I think that actually some people starting out with an awareness of this might see this film and have that kind of like reaction and become aware and discover things and become authentic themselves in the music they might. I mean, I don't mean that that's the source of their authenticity, but it can be a trigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, for me, the experience was being taken to see This Is Cinerama when I was 7 years old and being overwhelmed, and I ended up my entire life being movies. And you know, things like that, you hope that possibly things of authenticity, which I think this film is one, has that power to actually get people's imagination.
Well, let's go to our spokesperson for youth.
but I'm rapidly aging.
I know, you are rapidly aging. But before, it's almost a Dorian Gray kind of thing that we're seeing here. But no, I see, you know, what he's saying and what she's saying kind of goes back to your original comment about what it was like for you to see O Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. And to connect with the kind of music which, if I'm understanding you correctly, really wasn't part of your canon at that moment, you know? And obviously, you've grown up in a musically spavined era where you probably listened to way too much Tears for Fears, or I don't know. I don't even want to know what it
climb
means.
Out of that.
Yeah. But you seem to be saying that Coen Brothers movie connected you with something that you hadn't heard before.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm 32, people of America. What year did that come out? Does anyone remember? I feel like I was in college.
The Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah,
you probably were in
remember.
College. Let's say you were in college.
Okay, but before that, in high school, you know, I was Ani DiFranco obsessed. And she sort of was the torchbearer for the political folk music at the time. And I don't really know what she's up to these days, but I think she's still out there kicking around.
She's still out there kicking
around. Yeah, but, you know, the sort of older music I had not heard. She does new stuff. You don't hear a whole lot, you know. And I believe I've endorsed before on the show the Sea Shanty Night down in Essex, yep. Which I am obsessed with, and I wish it wasn't a Monday night so that I could go down there and, you know, get hammered and sing sea shanties every week.
Cliff Haslam.
Yeah, yes, exactly, Cliff Haslam and the Jovial Crew. And so I don't even remember what the question was anymore.
That question of authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Well, before ahead. I do that, I don't know about it. You mentioned, Teresa, mm-hmm. the Songcatcher.
Yes.
Which was mm-hmm. a film that also brought in mm-hmm. very old music, mountain music, music that had come from England and been...
This is this Aidan Quinn.
Right, and Janet McTeer, and there were some wonderful performers in it. Iris DeMent was in it doing a song, Hazel Dickens. People who really have made their bones, so to speak, in this kind of music.
Although, if this Coen Brothers movie occupies the same commercial niche as Songcatcher, somebody's going to be in a lot of trouble at some studio.
Right.
But anyway,
I think it's, you know, I think because it's a Coen Brothers movie, it's going to attract a different kind of attention for sure. So just remembering that you had mentioned that.
Well, the last question that I wanted to ask you, we probably should take a break pretty soon and kind of organize ourselves for endorsements and things like that. But one of the things we had thought about talking about here in the second segment, if we didn't have enough to say about Inside Llewyn Davis, was today there was a pretty interesting article by Jonathan Turley in the Los Angeles Times arguing for a pardon of Edward Snowden. And I was thinking, well, you know, if this were all happening in 1962, somebody would have already written a song about Edward Snowden, and maybe somebody has. But you do, you know, you play this kind of music on your show. It's thanks to you that I was aware of people like Eliza Gillickson and people like that who were writing kind of in real time protest mm-hmm. songs about the war in Iraq, which I wouldn't necessarily have been aware of any other way. So is that still going on? You were saying before the show there are NSA protest songs
absolutely.
Arriving on your desk.
Absolutely. I mean, starting back with Phil Oakes, I think of as coming out of the New York scene mm-hmm. a bit later than Llewyn Davis. But now we have Roy Zimmerman from California, who has performed in Hartford three times. And he's mostly very satirical. His protest songs are very pretty funny. He says funny songs about death, corruption, and greed, or something along that line. And he has a song about Hello, NSA, and it's done a la Elvis, you know, singing a sweet love song to his NSA listener inner kind of person. And, of course, Eliza, she has a new album coming out soon. She is certainly one of them. There are many. I mean, our friend Hugh Blumenfeld, though he's busy with other things, he still occasionally writes a really good, very succinct and perfect song about
it. So the protest song is not dead.
Oh,
anyway.
Oh my goodness, no.
As we're sort of running out of time and kind of wrapping up this segment, we would be remiss if we did not touch upon the other major musical news of the day. And if you're not aware of this, you may want to sit down. Justin Bieber is apparently not backing off his promise to retire after his album drops. And last night he proved, I think this is TMZ telling us, that he means, so you know it's true, he means business by reinforcing his retirement plans on Twitter. I could go on, but Teresa, how concerned are you about this? As the voice of America's youth at age 32.
I don't understand why everyone who makes, $100 million by the time they're 18 doesn't retire. That's what I would do. I would take my money to the wilderness of Canada or something and start an outpost. Bye, Justin.
Okay, bye. We love you.
I think it's a ploy for renewal.
Maybe he'll start singing folk songs.
Yes, exactly.
Protest songs.
People like Justin Bieber who say that they're retiring should be forced to live with that promise.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with endorsements.
Oh, baby, 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 oh. It's like baby, 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 oh, 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 baby. Baby, 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 oh, it's like baby, 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 oh, 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 baby, baby, baby. Justin, are you just going to sit around all day?
I don't feel like doing anything.
Well, there's a whole group of other retirees who go for walks around the mall early in the morning. You can, go try it. You could meet some other retired people.
Nah, I just want to stay home. Catch up on some things I missed when I was a superstar.
Is that why you retired, Justin? So you could just hang out around the house and be underfoot? Well, I have a life. I have a whole set of things I was doing before you decided to sit your sad Canadian butt down on this couch for the next 50 years.
Maybe I could call Usher, see what he's doing.
Yeah, you do that. I have announcements to make. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. I have a job, Justin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bob Dylan. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appears as certain other characters. For photos, links, articles, and a video of the Faith Middleton Show staff singing their folk hit, If I Had an Immersion Blender, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, we'll catch up with the weekend's news on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
If I had immersion blender. It's a hard song to sing, actually. Well, anyway, so we're back. We're here with James Hanley from Trinity Cine Studio, Teresa Graeber from The Cut, and Susan Forbes Hansen, a titan in the world of folk music broadcasting.
And Rich from it.
A rich titan, a wealthy titan.
Yep.
Here from the Susan Forbes Hansen mansion.
That's it.
She's reluctant to depart. All right, so
I'm retired.
This part of the show. That's right. She and Justin are retired. So this part of the show is endorsements, where we tell you about things that you might enjoy, things that we know about that you might enjoy. We may also all want to endorse pardoning Edward Snowden. Who knows what we'll endorse? Teresa Kramer, what are you going to endorse?
Well, I've been listening to the Llewyn Davis soundtrack for the past couple of weeks, but I've paired it with some things I'd like to endorse, including Patty Griffin's American Kid. Casey Musgraves, same trailer, different park. And Colin will appreciate this. The two little girls, Maisie and Lennon Stella from Nashville, who play Connie Britton's daughters. They have a few songs you can buy on iTunes, and some of them are original, some of them are not. But they're adorable, and they have the most beautiful little voices, and I can't stop listening to them.
Yeah, they actually are. Their little performances are written into the plot and into the action, such as it is, of Nashville, an ABC soap opera series to which I have become reluctantly and shamefully addicted. I will say that one of the few contrivances that I really feel that particular series gets wrong is it has a whole bunch of characters, all of whom are basically either performers or singer-songwriters or songwriters in Nashville, and only one of them is a recovering alcoholic, whereas they probably should have like one character who isn't an alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic and have that person stand for that Nashville anomaly. All right, so that's your endorsement?
Yes.
If you're fully endorsed, all right. James?
Well, I will endorse a pardon for the NSA for implying that Edward Snowden committed a crime. But also a book that we're reading at the moment, The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin, which so makes me wish that we had some really talented speakers, people who could put ideas out and actually get discussions going in politics. It's an incredible book. She's really a remarkable historian, of course, but the characters in it, you realize how much.
Set the scene a little bit for us. I think most people can probably conclude from the title what the book's about. But
well, it's about the Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and the whole it's really about the life that politics had when people could talk about ideas. Roosevelt, his ability, for instance, to be going from Teddy Roosevelt through Franklin Roosevelt, and the whole sense that society could actually have a massive conversation that everybody was involved in about responsibility, about how society could work, rather than being sort of a manipulation, that seeing it as a manipulation. And Doris Kearns Goodwin explains it in a way that is thrilling, and you realize what we're lacking. And one last thing, which is this Sunday, the Coventry Market is going, of course, again. I just wanted to give a shout out to the people who run the fish market, who are at the Coventry Market. They are also on Main Street in Willimantic, and just thank them for amazing fish and fresh fish bringing to the market every week.
They come up from Stonington, and their scallops are – Stonington has, like, the best scallops in the world, basically. Yeah. And these are their scallops are great, and they're all there. And they have interesting things, kinds of fish that you wouldn't even be able
exactly
to find at the supermarket.
Really amazing.
It certainly wouldn't be that fresh. All right. Susan Forbes Hansen, what have you got for us?
Well, inspired by your post about Rhiannon Giddens, having been delighted and surprised by her in that film about the music from Llewyn Davis. She is a force of nature, and she leads a band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's the only surviving, that's the wrong word, I think, member of the original group, which started about 8 years ago. The rest of the people have moved in and out, but she is incredible. She can sing Scottish mouth music, and she can sing Ethel Waters, and she can sing Hit 'em Up Style, and she can sing some fabulous black string band songs, you know. So that's one. And I also want to just give a shout out to all the local folk venues who are starting their season back up again. And you can find out about a lot of what's going on at folknotes.org. The Sounding Board just celebrated its 40th anniversary, 40 folken years, as they said. Shame on them. And folknotes.org.
All right. Very quickly, Jennifer Crooks is tweeting, please endorse New Year's Eve at the Bourse in New Haven with Violent May, Mission Music and 1974 online. I don't know what those things. I know about Violent May. That's about it. But anyway, consider that at least mentioned, if not endorsed. And I will endorse, first of all, this movie. If you can find a way to see it, this documentary, Another Day, Another Time. As far as I can tell, it's only on Showtime. I'm sure it'll be distributed in other ways as time rolls along here. This is this incredible coagulation of roots music talent. And I've sort of already mentioned them, but I'll quickly say a little bit more. A couple of the groups that are showcased that are of great interest, and I do believe that they will sort of break out in larger ways over the next year or 18 months. One of them is, and Teresa's already mentioned them, the Milk Carton Boys, which are very Simon and Garfunkel-like, but then so is that duet song that we just played from this movie. I actually have a playlist on my iPod. The playlist sounds like Simon and Garfunkel, because so many things actually do sound like Simon and Garfunkel, but the Milk Carton Kids you can add to that list in a very good way. And they also appear to be very funny, and we're actually hoping we can get them to come in studio during the coming year and play. The other group that we are wooing and courting, but then so is everybody else, is Lake Street Dive. This is a group that is built around the talents of Rachel Price, an amazing jazz singer, who instead of singing jazz in this particular configuration, they've released, I think, a 6-song LP, it's an EP or something that I got for Christmas, that's mostly covers of kind of classic soul things and Hall & Oates things and stuff like that. What they have that you can see immediately, and a lot of people have, more than a million people have, is a sort of a driveway. It's set up in a driveway, and it's a bass and a trumpet and I forget what else, and it's her. This kind of very street version of I Want You Back, the Jackson 5 classic. And if you do nothing else today, just get on YouTube and watch that once and then see if it doesn't get you very interested in Lake Street Dive. All right, here's another great soul singer, and Grayson Hughes is going to take us out.
Avon Farmington, yeah, on the radio. She on the radio.
On the radio, baby.
You and me talking, laughing down on the
Steppenwolf, and I gotta say, the acoustics inside Llewyn Davis really sucks. And could you lighten up on the whiskey up there? Your liver feels like a deflated football.